Good morning. It's 6 minutes after 9 o'clock, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Nine on Monday means all things political. We'll be discussing the major political stories from the past week with a pair of analysts, starting with David Winston, president of the Winston Group. Mr. Winston has served as strategic advisor to Senate and House Republican leadership for the past 10 years and was formerly the director of planning for Newt Gingrich when he was Speaker of the House. He also advises center-right political parties throughout Europe and is a columnist for the Capitol Hill newspaper Roll Call and a frequent guest on cable, network news, and National Public Radio. Good morning, Mr. Winston, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, John. How are you?
Well, pretty good so far. The day is young, though, so.
Give it some time, yes.
Yeah, I want to leave room for growth. I've learned that if I keep my expectations low enough, I'm hardly ever disappointed. Well, let's start with Europe, since that's an area where you have some concentration. Big news from Germany over the weekend, a victory for Chancellor Angela Merkel and her pro-business party. What do you make of this, and what, if any, are the implications for U.S. foreign policy?
Well, it's sort of a follow-up to the European elections that were held earlier in the year in June, where you saw sort of a center-right coalition sort of clearly emerge and do well. For Merkel, she had been in a coalition government with a more left-leaning group, and now she's going to be able to put together a more sort of center-right group. Where this goes, I mean, clearly the issue in Germany was taxes and nuclear power at this point. It looks like she had a reasonable win, and so we'll see policy-wise where that goes.
The NPR newscast that just preceded this program was talking about that story, and it sounded like that there were those in her party who wanted to move a lot faster than she might be willing to move. Is there going to be some friction there?
I'm not sure it's within her party. I thought it was the party that she's going to be, the Free Democrats, which is the sort of right party that did quite well in this election. I think those individuals are going to be pushing quite hard. She, having been in for obviously quite a few years here, I think she's just sort of looking at how do we get the next 3 to 4 yards done here, is I think going to be her approach initially. Ultimately, I think they will go with some tax cuts. Again, she was proposing reducing the tax from 14% to 12% in terms of individual income, whereas the other group, the Free Democrats, I think want to go to sort of their three basic rates. Sort of a flat tax concept. So they've got to figure out how they're going to resolve that.
Well, President Obama was at the United Nations last week where, among other things, he addressed the General Assembly, calling for international cooperation and pledging that the U.S. wasn't going to go it alone in terms of its own foreign policy. Assess his message to the world, and what does it mean?
Well, I think what he... From his point of view, what he's clearly trying to do is he thinks there are some relationships that have to be rebuilt from the point of view of the sense that the United States was not ignoring what other countries, where they wanted to go foreign policy-wise, but they were just sort of, this is what we're going to do, take it or leave it. And I think he believes that he's got to rebuild that. I think his speech has gotten mixed response because I think while there are a group of people who certainly wanted to see that attempt made, I think there was in a sense that perhaps he was sort of saying the United States had been wrong in a variety of different ways that perhaps may have gone too far, and so I think he's had a sort of mixed response, at least in terms of folks here in the United States. Having said that, we'll see how that plays out at a larger scale in terms of both from the reaction from UN and the sort of global response here.
Well, foreign policy last week seemed to push health care off the front page for a little bit anyway. Does the Obama administration risk getting distracted by foreign policy issues when they've got such a huge domestic agenda going on?
Well, two dynamics there. One, I think if you had said a half a year ago that when you look at the job approval of where Obama's at, that his strength would be foreign affairs and his weakness would be domestic, people would have thought you were nuts. But that's sort of what's evolved here. And so to some degree, he's gone to his strength for the short run. But ultimately, he's got a significant problem here in that the health care plan that he put up is in serious trouble. You're watching, at least at this point, a very different plan coming out of the Senate, specifically within one committee in the Senate, which is Baucus, which is the more centrist Democrat from Montana, who's the head of the Finance Committee, has been trying to put together a plan. He's just having some very significant difficulties, and the problem is he's got a variety of things on his plate at the moment. I mean, Afghanistan has come up in a way that I don't think he had anticipated. It's still unclear where cap and trade is at. Obviously, the overall riding issue in terms of the economy and jobs and health care, he's got a pretty full plate at this point.
Well, we have a caller who wants to talk about the Afghanistan issue, so we'll go ahead and do that. Just before we do, I want to give the phone numbers for everybody else. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is the toll-free number to use to join the program. If you want to send us an email, go ahead and do that. The address is talkwpr.org. We'll have David Winston with us until about 9:30, I understand, and then we have a second guest who will be joining us for the rest of this hour, but please call in. It's all things political here on this Monday, the 28th of September, 2009. Dan in Madison is our first caller this morning. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning to you and your guest. I would like to raise the issue of the U.S. aggression against Afghanistan, particularly the most worrisome aspect contained in the classified version of General McChrystal's recent 66-page report. What worries me is the general's implication that the continuing illegal occupation of Afghanistan will require the deployment of 500,000 additional troops over the next 5 years, and that amounts to an escalation on a Vietnam War scale. What's the Pentagon's rationale for such a fool's errand? After all, if one subscribes to the dubious official story of the 9/11 attacks, the group that destroyed the World Trade Center included 15 Saudi citizens. Yet no one I heard demanded the bombing of Riyadh in retaliation. My impression is that most Americans are less concerned about the large-scale loss of life in Afghanistan than the expense to the American taxpayers, and so in that light, I'd just like to notify the public that the New York Times reported in August that the Afghan quagmire is now costing the Treasury $65 billion annually, and I just feel that it's time to end this unwarranted aggression. It's an egregious violation of international law. And it's now obvious to most Americans that the mass of Afghan peasants weren't responsible.
I got a whole bunch of questions within that. First off, I'm not sure that I heard the number half a million. I thought it was somewhere in the neighborhood between 50 to 250. But there's another element here. Again, when Obama was running for president, he was clearly saying that the sort of strategy in terms of the war on terror was misguided in the sense of he thought it shouldn't be Iraq, it should be focused on Afghanistan. And so that's been his general direction. The problem that he's run into it has been not actually dissimilar to what happened in Bush's early years in Iraq, and that is, you have a political element that is concerned about the level of troops committed, and you've got folks on the ground who are saying, we need more troops. If you remember, Rumsfeld was arguing against committing more troops to Iraq, and ultimately it was John McCain who was pushing for what ended up being called the surge. To some degree, what you're looking at is the same choice here, where there's sort of a surge being recommended here. And I don't think Obama was prepared for how quickly Afghanistan deteriorated. And so right now they're in this the situation of deciding, do we commit to these additional troops, or, as the caller sort of reflects, some of the Democratic base having serious difficulties with committing additional force, in fact, wanting to go the other direction. So he's got a fundamental call here that he's going to have to make that is not going to be simple.
Well, then the other thing is, according to most of the reports I've seen, the elements of Al-Qaeda, which are supposedly what we're after, are actually in Pakistan anyway. And so there is some question about, okay, what are we there for, and, you know, how much longer is it going to take? There was a story that came out, I believe, over the weekend that suggested that the NATO governments and the United States were going to be behind Mr. Karzai and basically have anointed him. They've said, well, this guy's the person we're going to be dealing with for the next few years. He's going to be the eventual winner when all the dust settles from the election, and this is our guy, and so we're going forward with him. There are a lot of questions about the Karzai government, aren't there?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, and Dianne Feinstein, senator from California, who was on yesterday identifying that particular point, the idea that there's this element of one, the Taliban is beginning to clearly increase strength. That is a significant concern to the United States. But on the other hand, the way this last election occurred in Afghanistan, there were some serious concerns raised about that. And so how do you balance those two? And again, that's why I think for the Obama administration, the way the Afghan situation has evolved is not what they had anticipated, and it's gotten very complicated very quickly. And you're right, and you've got the dynamic, obviously, of the Pakistan border and how complicated Pakistan is just by itself without including Afghanistan. And they find themselves in a very difficult situation.
Going back to Iran, we mentioned that, just touched on it briefly, but Secretary of State Clinton was on, I believe, Face the Nation yesterday, among other places, talking about how the Iranians had to make their program much more transparent. Then the news came out that the Iranians had tested their medium-range missiles, and you've got Senator Graham saying we're headed for Armageddon. This is another real mess. What needs to happen in terms of what the world needs to the message to Iran about its nuclear program?
Well, again, not being the foreign policy expert here necessarily, but I think what you saw there, you've got two dynamics here. First off, just the concept of a country with, particularly with a leader like that, being able to have access to a nuclear weapon is obviously extraordinarily troublesome, and there's nobody who wants to see that happen. The question is obviously, how do you deter that? You're going to, from the United States, obviously see some diplomatic initiatives, not just directed at Iran, but sort of bringing in allies to sort of put pressure. But there's also the sort of not necessarily in the background, but clearly on everybody's mind, is Israel is likely to take some sort of initiative here if they don't think somebody else is going to do something, because they are unwilling to have Iran have a nuclear weapon, given some of the statements that have been made by Ahmadinejad about the Holocaust and all that. And so I think this is a very complicated and high-risk situation at this point.
We need to take a break, and then we'll come back. We have people who want to join us on the phone. If you'd like to do that, here's the number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org. My guest in this portion of the program is David Winston, president of the Winston Group. We'll be right back. And I'll just remind you again, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 20 minutes after 9 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Here's what's going on later on today on the Ideas Network. After 1 on Talk of the Nation, preparing for pandemic. Dr. Michael Kurtz rarely sees flu so early in the season, but the H1N1 flu makes this year different. He's seeing 30 to 50 patients a day test positive for the flu. Still, many feel the threat is overblown. That's the topic on Talk of the Nation this afternoon after 1 o'clock here on the Ideas Network. This hour, it's all things political, and my guest this hour is David Winston, who is president of the Winston Group. He's also served as a strategic advisor to Senate and House Republican leadership for the past 10 years and was formerly director of planning for Newt Gingrich when he was Speaker of the House. He advises center-right political parties throughout Europe and is a columnist for the Capitol Hill newspaper Roll Call and a frequent guest on cable network news and National Public Radio. He's with us until right around 9:30 this morning, and then we'll have another guest who we'll introduce at that time. We have a lot of phone calls to take, so let's go to the phones and take a call from Mike in Appleton. Mike, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Just two comments. We always talk country-specific. We talk Iran, we talk Iraq, we talk Afghanistan. But we should be talking about the region, because it's a regional problem. And what happens in one country has great influence on what happens in the other country. And the second comment I'd like to make is with regards to Israel. You know, without a doubt, to me, the Israelis have drawn a line, not in the sand, but in the concrete. They have a very specific date over which they're not going to, you know, they're not going to go past. And they'll do what they can do. They may lose half their air force, but I suppose in their calculation, if they set them back 5 or 6 years, that's a good thing. And that's, I mean, it's so crystal clear that that is what is going to happen. We should be preparing for that. Thank you.
Mr. Winston?
I don't know that I disagree with either comment. I mean, it is clearly a regional problem. I would agree with Mike on that. And at least at this point, it seems that Israel has pretty much kind of been pretty clear about what its intentions are. And it's just a matter of just how does this all sort of unfold. But like I said, again, there are a lot of foreign policy experts who could probably give you a lot better detail than I could in this particular case.
Let's take another call. We'll go to Chuck in Krivitz next. Hi, Chuck. Good morning.
Good morning. There's a question I was thinking about. Are we winning the peace there? I mean, we spend however many billions on military expenditures, but I saw something on TV, and it looked like what the people were needing was water in their village, and the officer who was talking to these villagers didn't really know what to say, because we didn't seem to have the money for that. They needed a well, and so I'm thinking maybe if we spent more money on infrastructure and getting the economy to work there, would that perhaps reduce some of the problems?
Now, I don't think there's any question that the infrastructure support is part of the demand coming from the Pentagon as well, along with additional military forces. To some degree, that was the dynamic in Iraq as well. It wasn't just simply a military solution. You had to build some infrastructure because, again, if you're not meeting people's basic needs, the satisfaction with the existing government obviously is not in place, and I think to some degree you're seeing that in Afghanistan. How quickly that can be turned around and what that decision looks like. Again, part of that goes to the sort of broader direction in terms of where Obama decides to go, if there's going to be the sort of engagement that was discussed in terms of the Pentagon report. That would likely include that. If there's a sense of trying to pull back, then I'm not quite sure what that looks like.
Well, let's talk about this as a political question for just a moment. The cost of whatever we do in Afghanistan, I mean, those are actual dollars that have to come from somewhere. Right now, I think they're probably coming from the Chinese. But at some point, you know, the bill is presented and has to be paid, and the dollars that we spend there are dollars that aren't available in this country for things like economic development and health care and so forth. What's the short and long-term political cost to the party in power if this situation persists?
Well, that's really complicated in the sense of again, I think of the two countries, when the invasion of Afghanistan first happened, right after 9/11, there was just it was widely accepted, widely supported, partially because you had the Taliban right there. So there's a concern around the Taliban that people have that, again, allowing for some additional spending might seem more reasonable. But you get to the broader question of now putting that in context of all the spending that's going on. What you've seen that I have not that I find really interesting is a concern when you ask what's the biggest issue that you think is facing the country. You've seen the deficit really begin to emerge as a pretty significant issue. It's still nowhere near the level of the economy or healthcare at this point, but it's beginning to increase as a concern and will play a larger role in the political process.
Let's talk about a domestic political story here. The White House has gotten involved in New York State politics. They had asked Governor David Patterson to bow out of the 2010 governor's race, and he said, thanks, but no thanks. I'm going to go ahead and run. Let's talk about that a little bit. This clearly is not the first time that a sitting president has had something to say about a state political situation, but those don't often make the newspaper.
No, and this is one of those. I'm sure the White House would have preferred to have this sort of back in the toothpaste tube. This didn't help Obama at all because unless Patterson was going to do what he suggested, it did not make Obama look particularly strong here. I grew up in New York, and so New York politics is always very complex and always very difficult, and probably best not to sort of engage when you don't have to in this particular case. Again, Patterson's got, like many states are facing at this point, facing serious income shortfalls because tax revenues are down. Taxes that they did in terms of increasing taxes, particularly on wealthier folks, did not emerge the way they thought they would in terms of revenues. And like many other states are facing just a very difficult financial situation. And so to pick on him in particular, I thought it was sort of an interesting juxtaposition, and I don't think helped him particularly at all. And I have to say, at a political level, I'm not sure that. I mean, I would suggest that was actually a blunder. He should not have done it.
Well, it certainly seemed that way. The way it came out. Let's see. I know you have to leave pretty quick, but let's take one more call before you have to go. We'll go to Kasser in Milwaukee.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I am going to go back to the Iranian nuclear issue. And I wish you would invite somebody who is very progressive in thinking about these things, somebody who's also a Muslim and can explain to you the Muslim point of view a lot more than an expert who has probably never visited Iran or that region. My point here is I do not believe in nuclear technology at all. But last 20 years, my eyes have opened up as to the biasness the U.S. has towards Israel. The issue that bothers me here is that Israel can do whatever it wants to, and we look the other way. And we are willing to sacrifice our children at the expense of Israel. And that is not right. It's absolutely not right for us to send our troops to protect Israel for the mistakes it makes towards its neighbors in the region. And we keep talking about the Holocaust. I believe in Holocaust. I know it happened. And I know that Ahmadinejad, I'm sure he knows, because he's a smart guy. He's not dumb. He's denying it for the right reason. And that is, if the Israelis have not, I mean, yes, there was a Holocaust, but unfortunately, did the Israelis learn from the Holocaust? Because they are turning around and doing exactly what the Nazis did to them. They're doing it to the Palestinians.
Certainly there is a feeling in the Middle East that the United States is biased toward Israel. Are we paying a political price over there for our support of Israel over the years?
I mean, there are some within the Middle East that are very hostile toward Israel. Israel's been a long-term ally. That has been a critical dynamic in terms of how Middle East policy has evolved over the years, and the Middle East conflict has evolved over the years. The idea of a fundamental change in terms of our approach, in terms of how we view Israel, I don't think is probably likely on the horizon for a whole bunch of very good reasons. Having said that, I mean, one of the things, and you saw Obama try to engage in this, as you've seen previous administrations, and that is, how do you sustain conversations between clearly very disparate groups that are very hostile toward each other, but now with the potential introduction of nuclear into this mix, make it even more essential to resolve. I mean, it's as you could hear from my point of view, anybody who somehow says it's okay if Ahmadinejad denies the Holocaust, the level of discourse that you're getting to is sort of frightening, actually, at that point. I think it reflects just the emotional nature, and not emotional is a negative term, but in the sense of the level of commitment people have to their positions, but the emotional nature of what this discourse sounds like, and that's why it's so potentially problematic.
David Winston, I know you have to leave us, and I really appreciate your time this morning. Thank you so much for being part of the program.
Pleasure as always.
David Winston has served as a strategic advisor to Senate and House Republican leadership for the past 10 years. He was formerly the director of planning for Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich and advises center-right political parties throughout Europe. And he was also a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation, where he did statistical policy and econometric modeling. He has served as a senior staff to four RNC chairmen. He's also a columnist for the Capitol Hill newspaper Roll Call and an election analyst for CBS. He's a frequent guest on cable network news and national public radio, not to mention this program. We are going to make a little bit of a shift. We have a new guest coming in just a moment. I'll mention, well, in case you just joined us, I am not Kathleen Dunn. Kathleen under the weather this morning, and so I'm John Munson filling in for Kathleen Dunn. We wish Kathleen a speedy recovery and back to the microphone as soon as she can, and I know that's what she would want as well. The program today is All Things Political. We have just made a change in guest. Let me introduce my next guest on the program, Chase Martin, managing editor of the Iowa Independent. He moved to Iowa 5 years ago from Palm Beach County, Florida, and he started the blog Iowa Progress back in 2006. And he's done a lot of things in Iowa, a lot of political work in Iowa for the Democratic Party and progressive candidates across the state. He holds a degree in philosophy from Grinnell College, and he lives in Des Moines. And as I mentioned, he is with the Iowa Independent. Good morning, Chase Martin. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Well, this is All Things Political. It's political stuff, and let's talk about a political question. Foreign policy kind of chasing health care reform off the front page last week and over the weekend as Barack Obama spoke at the United Nations. And then we had Hillary Clinton on the Sunday morning talk shows talking about Iran. We had Iran with its missile tests. We've got things going on in Afghanistan and so forth. Plus or minus for President Obama?
Well, you know, I think politically speaking, it's probably both a plus and a minus. And you know, it seems almost cruel to talk about foreign policy in these terms, but I think part of the truth is simply that the foreign policy is going to distract from the domestic policy, and right now President Obama is really trying hard to keep the country focused on health care. But I do think that there's a second half to the equation, and that is that when the president has, you know, really clear foreign policy objectives, and when most Americans are going to agree with the president on foreign policy, you know, it might actually be politically advantageous to a president to be conducting foreign policy. You know, that's a much less partisan role that the president has to play, and when Americans see him playing that role, they start to envision him more as, you know, a president who leads the whole country rather than simply a Democrat or even a socialist or a communist or whatever some of his critics have been calling him recently. So I think well, politically speaking, it might help him actually advance his policy goals a bit to be involved more in foreign policy.
It still seems a little odd, though, and my previous guest made this observation. Basically, if someone had said, a year ago that in September of 2010, President Obama's approval on foreign policy issues would be better than his approval on domestic issues, most people would have said, "Well, that's crazy." So it does seem there is a little bit of strangeness here. He does better on foreign policy than domestic. Does that just mean, is that just a reflection of the fact that maybe some of these domestic issues are a lot tougher to solve and a lot more difficult?
Yeah, I think that has a lot to do with it, to be honest. You know, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find many Americans who want the president to be, you know, less aggressive against Iran if Iran is truly pursuing nuclear weapons or, you know, anything like that. I just think President Obama so far hasn't really had to get too involved in really partisan foreign policy questions the way that he has been forced to get involved in very partisan domestic policy questions. Even his plans, for instance, to withdraw troops from Iraq, you know, he redeployed troops out of Iraqi cities earlier this summer amid very little fanfare, almost tried to keep Americans focused on domestic policy while he did it. And, you know, that was probably the most controversial foreign policy decision he's made so far. And it largely, I think, went under the radar. To a certain extent, I think it's also just becoming more and more the mainstream view that Americans should be withdrawing from Iraq, or at least should be relying more on the Iraqis to do the day-to-day work and should hold back as they are right now in Iraq. So I think mostly it's simply that he hasn't had to make as many controversial decisions in foreign policy, and the ones that he has made have just not gotten the headlines that the domestic policy questions that he's been trying to answer have.
What do you make of Senator Graham's comments, I think, on Face the Nation yesterday that we were headed for Armageddon?
You know, I think that's the kind of comment that can only help President Obama. You know, it's the kind of argument that I think most people will just respond to by saying that seems a bit outlandish. It seems a bit, overly polemic. It seems just a bit vitriolic. And, you know, I think when President Obama was faced with those sorts of arguments during the campaign, he dealt with them well. I think, you know, a lot of the reason why he won is because of the backlash that eventually fomented against the opponents of him who were making those sorts of arguments. So I actually think that he sees those sorts of arguments as politically beneficial to him in the long term, even if in the short term they do lead to real questions and, you know, a lot of confused people. It in the end, I think, will benefit him to have the other side seem more and more extreme.
Let's take some phone calls. Actually, before we go to the phones, I want to give the phone number again, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. It's all things political here on this Monday morning. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Let's go next to Jim in Milwaukee. Good morning, Jim.
Hi. The late George Carlin said that we should teach our kids to read, not just to read, but to question what we read. And it seems to me that in terms of the media, that what happens in the news that is reported and what is omitted, lies of omission, is very important. And I'd like in my call to illustrate the idea that the media is not to be trusted. The media is not pro-liberal. In fact, it's pro-conservative. And that it's incumbent upon us to demand even-handed treatment of the media. Last week, John Edwards, again, information came out which revealed how sleazy he was and suggested, of course, that he's not fit to hold office. And I don't have any problem with that. But what I do have a problem with is a double standard. Elliot Spitzer, for example, was a politician who consorted with prostitutes and cheated on his wife, and he had to leave office. But David Vitter gets to stay in office. Ensign's gets to stay in office. The governor of South Carolina stays in office. And, of course, Larry Craig, the toe-tapper, gets to stay in office. And it seems to me that if the media was liberal, they would have been asking for the Republicans to leave, just like they asked the Democratic cheaters to leave, which was appropriate. And also, I think the liberals would have, if the media was liberal, they would have defended the free speech rights of Van Jones. But they didn't do this. And so we live with this lie that the media is liberal. And if they'll lie to us about the media being liberal, what else will they lie to us about?
I think that's an interesting point. I think if you asked former Governor Spitzer in New York if he should have resigned, given another year in office before the scandal broke, he might have changed his mind because, frankly, you know, it does seem as if other scandals that are equally bad have broken since then that haven't, you know, generated the same kind of furor that his scandal did. Of course, there was more of a question of hypocrisy in his case than in the case of, say, John Edwards or really any of those others, simply because Spitzer had been intricately involved in prosecution in his position before he became governor of New York. So there is that question. But I do think that's a fair point. Frankly, having met a lot of members of the media, there are certainly plenty who do hold an ideological bias one way or the other. And I think that there are certain news outlets that are certainly moving in that direction, both to the left and to the right. And, you know, there are maybe benefits and disadvantages to that trend. But I think the majority of media, to the extent that they omit certain things or to the extent that they forget to report on certain things, a lot of cases it's just shortcomings of the format that they're using, whether it's television or newspaper or radio. You can only say so much in a certain amount of time. And your job is to try to summarize things as best you can and hit the high points for the public so that they get as much of the story as you can give them. But really, it's just an impossible job sometimes. There's usually a lot more to the story than you can convey in the amount of space that you have, especially as news organizations are cutting back further and further and you have less space to fill on a newspaper because there are more ads being printed and that sort of thing. So I think, you know, part of it, there could be a bit of a political agenda at some of these media outlets, but I think in large part this is just a problem we've always had that keeps getting worse as the business of journalism gets, you know, unfortunately less and less profitable. So I think the point is well taken, but I also think that, you know, a lot of the problems stem not from really malicious intent from any journalists, but simply the shortcomings of their format and, you know, their inability so far to really deal with the problems with profitability in the industry.
Well, I have a problem with the term the media, particularly when the media gets followed by the word is.
Sure.
Because the assumption,
it's not monolithic.
and there is a there are tremendous differences in terms of the skill level of various journalists who are practicing. Some need more practice, and others are very good. And you know, to say the media assumes some sort of person or entity at some point that's pulling all the strings and making all the decisions, and clearly it would be problematic to establish that such a thing exists.
Absolutely, I think as both of us who have worked in quote unquote the media could say, you know, it's a lot of times a lot more organized chaos than anything else. There really isn't some, you know, person behind the curtain pulling all the strings. You're absolutely
right,
on that point.
More chaos than organization. Let's see. Let's take a question from Dave in Menominee, Michigan.
Well, hi, thanks. One quick comment on the media. What has happened is they're just afraid of being accused of being lefties. And so they bring on a left and a right, one at a time, so that it's a he said, she said thing, and then the media doesn't say we investigated and found out the truth. So that's the problem. Well, but here's my comment. McChrystal, here, we have this general now that's a high commander. He was, you know, in charge of all the special forces, you know, the Green Berets and the Rangers, and was very close with Dick Cheney. And I just find it really odd now that this memo got leaked, you know, a McChrystal memo got leaked about, you know, all this, you know, we've got this Democrat in now, and it's just bad news, you know, and the droning on of bad news since Obama has been in office from the media has caused a lot of trouble. I wanted to get your comments on how close McChrystal was with Cheney, and, you know, how Cheney had come out and was warning us how much danger we're in, and then this memo gets leaked, and
sure. Well, you know,
is this just coincidence? I won't believe that.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a problem that a lot of new Democratic presidents have faced. You know, I think President Clinton faced a similar dynamic, or at least there was the perception, you know, outside the Beltway that was happening when he first took office. You know, it's no secret that the military leadership in the United States is generally more pro-Republican than pro-Democratic. But, you know, I think you could make the same argument, perhaps an even stronger argument, about Secretary Gates, whom President Obama asked to stay on after he took office. You know, that he was perhaps from a different school of thought than the Rumsfeld school or the Wolfowitz school of thought when it came to military strategy, but he was still very close with the Bush administration. And, you know, I think that if President Obama thought that there was someone he could trust more to put in that position or to put in the position that McChrystal currently holds, you know, he probably would have done so. You know, I think you could make an equally interesting argument about how the Obama administration may benefit from having that memo leaked, because there was, you know, a lot of anger fomenting on the left about Afghanistan troop levels, and everybody kind of knew that McChrystal was going to be asking for more troops before the report leaked. So it wasn't a huge surprise. You know, I wonder a little bit whether that memo was leaked intentionally so that there could be a bit more time to consider a troop increase before the president had to really spend time going out there and rallying for a troop increase when he wanted to be focused on health care. So I think the politics of it are maybe a little bit less simple than that. I think, you know, there's an argument to be made that Obama actually benefited from having that memo leaked, just because he didn't then have to be the one to ask for it. It could come out more slowly, and it wouldn't necessarily make the front page across the country immediately.
Well, it wasn't exactly a memo. It was a long report, and it was a two-part deal, and the second part hasn't been leaked. So we don't even know what's in that, and it may not be anything that's even relevant to the discussion, but it was a significant thing, and it did offer some opportunity for public discussion of the issue. So maybe, as you say, it was done strategically.
Sure.
It certainly wouldn't be the first time that's happened.
Exactly.
We need to get to a break, and when we come back, we have more callers who want to join us, but still a line available for you if you call right now, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, the email address talk@WPR.org. My guest in this half hour of the program is Chase Martin, managing editor of the Iowa Independent. We'll be right back. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Wisconsin Public Radio wants to hear from you. Join WPR's new online community, connect with other public radio listeners, and take part in discussions before, during, and even after the show. Go to WPR.org to learn more.
It's 9:48. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Well, later on this afternoon, I'll be in for Ben Marins. And after 5, we'll be talking about black bears. Black bears commonly perceived as a threat by many people, and hunting them is often viewed as keeping bear numbers tolerable. After 5 today, my guest will talk about common misconceptions about black bears. That's later on this afternoon. What's the over-under on my misidentifying who I'm filling in for today, I wonder? My guest this hour in all things political is Chase Martin, managing editor of the Iowa Independent. Let's go back to the phones. And, a lot of people want to talk about this Iran situation and their potential for nuclear mischief. Cody and Coleman, you'll be next. Hi, Cody.
Hi. I was just wondering, with the nuclear deal here over in Iran, they say they launched this missile that can reach Israel or whatever. I guess my question is, we spend an awful lot of money, trying to stop nuclear weapons from being made. And I believe in the last program you had, somebody said there was like 30,000 nuclear missiles in our arsenal. Why can't we just, instead of spending all this money, and why can't the diplomatic be as simple as this, is, okay, Iran, make your nuclear missile, do whatever you do there. But if you launch this thing, we have 10,000 missiles pointing back at you, and we're going to wipe you off. And just let them have their nuclear missile, because they're never going to use it. I guess I just want to comment on that.
Sure. Well, that would be the theory that got us pretty much all the way through the Cold War, called mutually assured destruction. Now, the problem that foreign policy thinkers see with that going forward in today's world is that they aren't quite as sure now that the folks that we'd be targeting with these nuclear weapons are quite as rational as the Soviet Union was during the Cold War. Whether that's a real calculation or not, is up for a lot of debate. But I think the fear is simply that Ahmadinejad won't care whether his country would get destroyed and might launch a nuclear weapon anyway, or really, more Kim Jong-il in North Korea, the prospect of being blown up by the United States after he launches a missile wouldn't necessarily deter him from launching a missile in the first place. So I think that's the fear.
The experts that I've interviewed on this question of Iran's nuclear program haven't been as much concerned about Mr. Ahmadinejad launching a missile at Israel, which would certainly just about guarantee that Iran would be a parking lot a few minutes later. But the concern has been that if they do develop nuclear weapons, that they might fall into other hands of people less likely with no strategic risk. Because if you're a terrorist organization with no real country, what are you defending? And what is it, mutually assured destruction of what?
Sure.
That seems to be a bigger concern than whether or not the Iranian government would actually do anything as foolish as lob a nuclear bomb at somebody else.
Sure, absolutely. When a terrorist shows up with a bomb in his suitcase, it's pretty difficult to trace where he comes from. And, even if you can make assertions about where he or she comes from, then you get into similar problems that we are experiencing in Afghanistan now, where we invaded Afghanistan, essentially because the 9/11 hijackers came from there. But now most of the organization that planned 9/11 is in Pakistan. and we're still in Afghanistan because the way the world stage still works is you invade a country, not, you know, so it becomes very complicated. That's a good point.
Let's see. Let's shift our focus just a little bit here. We'll take a call from Bob in Lake Tomahawk.
Hi there.
Good morning.
Morning. I'm talking about health care reform. And what I'd like to do is to, I'm a proponent of health care reform, but I don't like what's coming out of Congress. What I propose is having two bills. Incidentally, the first bill is going to be exclusively cost reduction, because if that doesn't go into effect, the whole any plan is going to fail. And the other bill is going to be on health care reform itself. Now, as this is a bill that's going to impact over 300 million people. As an IBM retired systems engineer, when we developed a program, we never gave it to the customer without testing it first. We went through alpha test, beta test, and every kind of test before we would subject all the customers to this bill or program. So I'm saying that we can come up with a second bill on health care reform, and you can have as many combinations and permutations as you want. And we're going to submit each bill for a trial. And each state would have a specific program. And, you know, everybody wants to change, have a different technique. You can have as many bills as there are states, but they're going to be at a trial. It's not going to be carved into stone until we find out that it works. And nobody's going to be upset because it's only a trial. So after 2 or 3 years, the cost will be reduced, and a good plan will have materialized. That's my approach.
Okay, thanks, Bob.
Okay.
I think that's an interesting idea, but I think, you know, the President Obama's supporters would argue that it can't be separated into two bills, that the cost reductions would come directly from the reform measures that they're proposing. And they'd also argue that unless it happens on the scale of an entire country, you won't really be able to see the benefits. You know, Massachusetts, for instance, has had a fairly similar, half market-based, half state-based solution to health insurance reform for a few years now, and they've had some benefits, but it's pretty clear from what they've experienced there that they would save a lot more money if what they were doing happened on a much larger scale. It's just a question of economies of scale, and doing it state by state, you know, simply wouldn't save the kind of money that you're trying to save.
Well, and the number of uninsured in Massachusetts is actually growing.
Yeah, well, that's also true because, you know, they have trouble enforcing their individual mandate, and they also have trouble keeping costs low enough where they don't have to, you know, issue as many waivers to people who can't afford health insurance. You know, if they could keep costs really, really low and create an option for people that was cheap enough, you know, there's at least some speculation that they'd be able to greatly increase the number of people on the insurance rolls. It's just a question of right now, low-income people have to be granted a waiver so that they don't have to get health insurance simply because the state can't make a health insurance option cheap enough for them yet.
You made an observation that I just wanted to point out because I'd like you to expand on it. You used the phrase health insurance reform. That's really what's being debated in Congress. They're not even talking about health care.
Yeah, and I think that's also a fair point. I think politically the Obama administration made a calculation that they were better off shifting the term to health insurance reform from health care reform as well. So, you know, they want people to be thinking more about it in terms of health insurance reform. That sounds better to people who already have insurance, and it makes it seem like it's a less dramatic change that they're trying to make. During the campaign, what we're talking about now was called health care reform. But I think you're right. It is more accurately described as health insurance reform, and I think supporters of it are trying to shift to that language for their own political interests.
I want to get one more call in here before we're done. Randy and Madison, I'm just going to ask you to be brief because we've got about a minute and a half left in the program.
Exactly. I just want to say how incredibly refreshing it is to hear somebody in the media, but in your case it's News and Public Affairs, know that the media are plural, or the media as a term is plural, that a apparently people are trying to make a point that, oh, the media really is monolithically pro-conservative, but not only are so many different media, usually people use it just to mean television, but I don't think anybody would want to have the range of sources we had, say, in 1969 versus what we have today. There's much, much more media to deal with. That's all, but congratulations for knowing that media is plural.
Okay, thank you very much. Final thoughts on the media. Are we better off now than we were in 1969? Some people would dispute that.
I think there are definitely downsides to having an increasingly diversified media, so to speak. But I think, you know, just in terms of the ability for the true information to rise to the top and for more people to have access to more information, at least if they seek it out and have a critical eye, you know, I think the benefits of that are difficult to understate. I think, you know, the situation is definitely better than it was 30, 40 years ago. There are certainly still unscrupulous characters out there trying to peddle information that's false, trying to manipulate people. And there's certainly more room for rumors to take fire and really, you know, manipulate people and scare people. But at the same time, you know, someone like me would not have had an opportunity to get into the media at all if we were still in the environment that we were in 1969. You know, it's much easier to break in, and good reporting really does rise to the top, and I think people do recognize it. So I think it's a lot more democratic now than it used to be.
And we're out of time. Thank you very much, Chase Martin, for being part of the program today.
Thank you very much.
Chase Martin, managing editor of the Iowa Independent. Rhonda Fanning produced this program. Rob Schroeder handled on-air production. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. If you want to listen to this program again a little later today, you can go to our website, WPR.org. Go to Kathleen's page, and you'll find a link to the audio right there. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a few minutes.